Welcome to the Navit Gaming Podcast, where it is our mission to explore the business and future of video games. We bring together the industry's brightest builders, investors, and thinkers to keep a pulse on current events, dissect emerging trends in games, share lessons learned, and have a great time. This podcast is also part of Navit's growing ecosystem, which ranges from free and premium research to consulting and advisory services. For more information, visit www.navic.co. This episode is brought to you by NEFTA. NEFTA has created an advertising network that pays game publishers higher eCPMs on their iOS opt-out users and drives better results for advertisers. This works by delivering their campaigns to more receptive and relevant audiences using first-party data and behavioral analytics on an app-by-app basis. A simple two-step integration enables them to drive superior results for advertisers while increasing ARPDAU for publishers in a 100% privacy-compliant way. You can learn more about how NEFTA can boost your results at nefta.io. Now, let's jump into the episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Navic Roundtable. I'm your host, Devin Becker. And with me, of course, two fantastic guests. We've got Dave and Tammy joining us for our pre-GDC episode here. As I believe both of you will be there, and a lot of us, I think, won't be in effect.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, really excited to make it out there for GDC. If you see us on the street, stop, at least for me, stop me, say hi. Definitely want to connect with as many people as possible.
Absolutely.
I guess I'll have to watch the YouTube if they only just listen right to actually get the visual for that. Recognize.
Yes, or the cover for the episode.
Right, the
but
thumbnails,
I won't be carrying my dog, so you can't rely on that.
Yeah, that was the signature move. Cool. We have a few different topics here to talk pre-GDC, but I think a lot of people are saving all their big guns for GDC itself. So I imagine there's a little bit of a slowdown just before, and then I think we'll have a lot to talk about also after GDC. So definitely stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, I think we have a few interesting topics here. I think to start with one that I think people probably saw coming after all of our discussions of it last year around another Super Mario movie.
Hell yeah. So just a little one to start. It's been confirmed because we were all speculating that given the success of the first Super Mario movie, the odds of us seeing a second one, a sequel, would be very high. It's confirmed. And if you read a little bit about the press release, they're basically trying to keep like the formula or the chemistry of the teams that made the first one to make sure that kind of it carries the same feel that really resonated with all of us. Excited to see that. It's going to be a few years before we get to enjoy it, but it's part of a topic that we've been covering quite a bit here, which is this push to leverage game IP more and more across movies, TV series, theme parks. And they even mentioned this in the press release that the Super Mario World IP is just it's expanding more and more. So I think beloved Super Mario is not going anywhere. It's just getting stronger, and we're going to have another movie to enjoy.
We also have the Zelda one as well that was announced a little while back, done by the same people. So it's interesting that they went with Illumination for the first one and then went with a different company for the second one and then still continuing with Illumination for the sequel to this one. So clearly it wasn't the case with the Zelda movie. They were just like, we weren't happy with Illumination. It was more just, let's diversify how we're doing these. So interesting that they're spreading that out a little bit, although I'm sure those companies out there looking to get those gigs are very happy to see that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll see what other good IP and properties Nintendo starts going after. I can also see a place where we start seeing like these side stories for the Super Mario universe has like so many side characters that resonate with different audiences. So I can see that also coming our way at some point.
I'm really hoping for a Wario movie then. I think that would be the nice twist on things.
I was going to say Luigi's Mansion. Get a little bit of cartoon.
Yeah, Luigi's Mansion.
Yeah, give it that Scooby-Doo vibe. I definitely see that could also be something that ends up being like a smaller scale thing, the way like Netflix did a lot of those sort of almost direct to video kind of ones that were like continuations of popular like DreamWorks movies and things like that, like shorts or other things. If this stuff continues to be successful, I imagine we could see, like you're saying, spinoff stuff, but also even like that sort of smaller stuff just meant for kids to watch in that sort of, it was direct to video. Now it's just direct to streaming, I guess, whatever you want to call it. Business model where, you know, Netflix has a lot of transmedia stuff. So I could see them for sure being a candidate for something like that. But I'm sure as long as it's continued to do good, it's beneficial for all of us, because I think this has been a period where most of the transmedia has been pretty high quality. So it's nice to see that it's not just churning stuff out. And as soon as people start slipping, we might start to see a little backpedaling. But until then, full speed ahead to them. We
have replacing all the Marvel content as they scale yeah. back from too much superhero movies. Now we're going to get a whole bunch of video game movies.
I mean, the superhero movies were transmedia as well, just from comics instead of games, although obviously there's games and all that. So it's definitely an inspiration, right? Rather than coming up with these scripts themselves from scratch, might as well take advantage.
Now, what I'm waiting to see is the Waluigi movie or side story, like little short. That would be fun.
Like they did it a bit with Bowser kind of being fun in the first ones. I might as well make some more ones where bad guys are fun. It's been a bit of a trend I've noticed, especially from Disney, where they're like leaning into the villains being their own interesting characters and having their origin movies, and even some of the games and stuff are starting to incorporate them a bit more. So definitely plenty of opportunity for that. Or even if Bowser just had his own movie, you could see that like when he's a kid or something. They could go so many directions with that stuff. The media the story, as you said, is just rich at this point in terms of lore. So it's plenty of it. And there was so many Easter eggs and fan service in the first one. Imagine there'll be plenty more of that. It's plenty to work off of.
They do the same thing that Capcom did when they did Street Fighter the movie. Then they had Street Fighter the movie, the video game, where there'll be Super Mario the movie, the video game.
There was Lego movie games and stuff too that felt like it was like basically, because the movie itself almost looked like it was sometimes like the game. And it's just, it feeds itself in a circle. I imagine we could definitely see something like that for sure. Why not? If you could do a partnership with Nintendo one way, why not the other way as well? But the question is, who would make the game? Would it be Nintendo, or would that be a partnership deal? Because obviously Illumination doesn't make games.
There might be one or two companies that put their hand up and saying, we'll do it.
Which feels very anti-Nintendo. So right. That I think that will be a hard one to see materialize.
I think the partnership with Ubisoft was probably like one of the few we've seen in a while where they really, it was a big deal and they did pretty well with it. So never know.
The company in Vancouver that Nintendo ended up buying, but ended up doing a number of games for Nintendo, like Super Striker. They were like a pretty solid second party company for Nintendo. Who knows? Maybe it's an opportunity for another situation like that.
Definitely. Well, everyone out there, start making your spec games and pitches. Get ready for the onslaught of transmedia. Speaking of people getting organized, some fruit coming, I think, from some of these union attempts over the last couple of years that we've seen like a lot of.
Yeah, I would say probably the biggest success story that the unions would say they've had to date. A group of around 600 quality assurance workers have unionized at Activision Blizzard, or the studios that were Activision Blizzard, now under the Microsoft umbrella. And interestingly, the union's already been recognized by Microsoft as part of an agreement that Microsoft signed with the Communications Worker Alliance back in 2022. So there's no challenges in terms of Microsoft recognizing the union. And it does seem to be that Microsoft's been fairly open in terms of, or at least let's say neutral, in terms of dealing with any unionization attempts inside their overall organization. So there's approximately now 1,000 employees that are represented by the unions inside Microsoft. And that's across like Raven, Blizzard, ZeniMax. And this new group of QA workers, they're across a number of different studios. So it affects studios in California, in Texas, and in Minnesota. A fair number now covered under the union set inside Microsoft. For me, I'm wondering, I got a couple of questions. I think number one, I'm seeing a lot of the unionization happening inside some of the more areas where work is certainly more precarious. So quality assurance is certainly one of those. It tends to be a little bit more cyclical in terms of when people are brought on to projects and projects over or shipped, a number of them being let go. Will we see the union attempts staying inside the more the QA style positions, or will we see it more across the board where we see entire studios becoming unionized? And is this really one of the key, one of the real effects of having so many layoffs happen in the last little while where people are looking for an ability to help at least negotiate a better severance or help, you know, make it a little bit more challenging for people to be laid off in the current climate? Curious as to what your guys' thoughts are.
I guess I have a couple questions before you get into it too much in terms of details. And in that, does this affect both outsourcing and contract workers? Because those are two alternatives. Let's say this becomes problematic for them in terms of the unions costing them maybe a bit more, or they maybe scale down on full-time hires. Is that like the workaround that they start then maybe outsourcing more or working with more contract temp worker style? I'm just curious. I don't understand the details of the union part.
So I actually do recall there was a situation where an outside group, an outsourced group did unionize. And then that group was actually let go. They were no longer being utilized as part of outsourcing QA group. I think with the recognition of the union, there's also the recognition of what are the requirements or what are the terms in terms of they'll be working, continuing work for, you know, Microsoft or whichever studio. I'm not someone who's really familiar with usual union terms. I've been in management for the last little while, so I'd be one of those people that would be excluded from any sort of union. I think at this point, I think with Microsoft actually recognizing the union, I don't think that's a case where they'd say, hey, you guys have unionized. We're now going to just release a lot of you. So I think there certainly are some aspects that their positions are a lot more protected right now.
That's good to hear. Thoughts, Tammy?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of thoughts for sure around the union piece. One of the questions that you had is, or open questions was, how are we going to, is this the effect of recent layoffs? I think that it's probably just part of like momentum that the union efforts have been getting. There's been talks about unionizing efforts across the gaming industry for many years, if not decades, because the conditions have always been precarious, right? Like right now we're seeing these massive layoffs, but there's been all sorts of other quote unquote exploitative practices within the industry where there's like this the big hire pushes and then the big layoffs and pushes and layoffs around like box game releases. I think that we are seeing a lot of that also gain momentum and come into fruition. I think that part of it's definitely like a tricky topic to talk about. First of all, I think that it's a fantastic win for unionizing efforts, especially in North America, because North America specifically just makes it that much harder for employee groups to unionize because you have to, I'm not an expert either on unionizing or anything, but I know that there's like in certain European countries, you can just gain some critical mass and then go to the employer and say, we're negotiating with you as a union. And basically that's first you get the group and then you go to the employer. In the US, you have to file a petition with labor relations, with the labor relations board, and do a vote as a whole unit. And all of this is happening while the employer knows. This gets, as soon as you're like, open the door, the employer knows. And that incites in a lot of union busting practices. So to what you were saying, Devin, of like, hey, can they perhaps go more the route of like outsourcing and contractors to avoid unionizing, like before they recognize a union? Yes. And that's part of some of the unionizing, like busting practices that some big corporations take on of, hey, now, you know what? We're not going to block you, but we're not going to hire you. We're going to start hiring more over here and like all sorts of different things. So again, back to specifically like what we're seeing right now, I do think it's a huge win because now that Microsoft has recognized these unions, now that's formal, that gives them a seat at the table to really start negotiating whether it's better salaries or as you mentioned, Dave, the conditions and terms of layoffs and severance packages. So that if you do end up facing that, it just, you know, it's under much better conditions for the group that is being impacted. So I think, and a little bit of a ramble there, but I do think that there's a lot that gets mixed in with like unions, but it really like a union is a group of people. So they're going to represent their interests. So it really is like that, giving them that seat at the table and advocating just to have a better workplace and a little bit more transparency and the resources that they need. So overall, I think it'll be good to see how those efforts start coming to fruition with these recognized unions. And I think that depending on that is whether it gains more momentum. And I can see that expanding to other teams that are usually underpaid, like community management, for example, is the first one that comes to mind. It's like QA, community management, customer support. Like, there's a lot, I think, that those groups will probably be looking at from these efforts and see if, you know, they can follow suit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, it's probably going to be the groups that companies that, I hate to say it, see some positions as being a little bit more disposable, that there are people that come in, they come out, they don't see them as necessarily someone they are looking to bring into a company over for many years, who don't have that, they don't have that balance in terms of the power structure inside the company. I think if a group of engineers got together and said, hey, if we don't see some changes, we're all going to leave. Unfortunately, right now, I would say that group of engineers probably have a lot more power, so to speak, inside that company than a group of QA. That the company would probably see the QA as a little bit more easily to replace. There are some groups that would probably see it as, well, I just grab some QA off the street.
To be fair, it is an entry-level position for a lot of people, and there was a lot of people back in the day that worked their way up the company from there. So it does make sense that it's considered a little more replaceable if it is that the qualifications are lower.
Yeah, but at the same time, there are people that have put, you know, great effort towards the company and should be treated as decent humans, which hopefully every company would treat all of their employees. But I do think, Tammy, I agree with you that it's probably the areas of QA, of CS, community management that are probably going to be more likely to work towards forming the unions, the representation in some of the other areas.
The other discipline area that I think would follow suit as well potentially is the artist. Because it's crazy to me, since quote unquote art outsourcing is accessible, it also, it's very volatile for artists to be working in the gaming industry. So I think that there's like a lot of different disciplines that would probably like, if we see good progress made with these unions, that will hopefully like very quickly start organizing as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we'd end up going closer to more of the film model? So film, very much a union-driven industry where they have a production company, they have a small group of people that are the so to speak, top-line people, and then they contract out everybody else. They contract out the actors, they contract out the all the various disciplines, from props people through to cameramen through to all the various aspects. Do you see the potential for the games industry moving more towards that model if we move away from this, our current sort of collection of people inside of an individual studio?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about it in that way. It is an interesting question because I think that it would take a really long time to get there, just because it's like a philosophy. I think of, if you ask a lot of people in the industry, like what makes the best games, is like teams that have worked together throughout like challenges and mini games, and that's why you also see teams trying to get back together even if they've parted ways at some point. So I think it's not only like a structural change that would need to happen, but it's very much like a ideological change that would need to happen. So I think that there's some added tensions there.
Well, I think the part of that to consider is exactly what you're talking about, which is the people that are familiar working together. And the main benefit for the film industry, part of the reason why it works and is adapted to it, is because it all predictions are generally temporary, right? The project comes and goes. There's not like ongoing DLC for it or live service yet. I don't know. Maybe all that changes. Maybe they go to the games model and then we go to the film model. But the thing is, you sort of need some sort of assurances, right? The reason we don't do the studio model is there's not really a lot of assurances between the gigs in terms of like future work, getting hired, make sure you don't get just replaced. And so that ability to bring together people with a sort of standards and a pool of people that have a lot of different things built up around it. And that makes it easier to do that. And if you look at the way the film industry does it, a lot of times it is exactly what we're talking about. People that have worked together tend to hire a lot of the same crew because they know they're reliable. They know how they work. It's not terribly different at all. It's more just like this was the nature of the beast for films. And unions really helped make sure that wasn't just pick up people, drop them, pick up people, drop them in a way that like there wasn't really like a lot built around that. And I think in this case, that probably would be helpful in making it so that games don't have, because there is like this kind of weird sort of transition between games when you make a game and then you either immediately start on the next one or you're like spending a while going, what do we make next, guys? Like films don't really have that. You don't just sit around kind of, what do we make next, guys? That's, you go shop whatever your project you have around and try and get it greenlit, but then build it from the top down via director or screenwriter or whatever, via the studio heads. And it's a very different structure that way. But financially, it does make some sense based off of how they build it. But at the same time, I think it's a little easier for a film to build what it plans to build than a game where they have to find a lot of it in the middle. And I think that part is probably actually the bigger challenge. And maybe their pre-production is really like heavy prototyping, figuring it out before you're trying to get it greenlit and things like that. Obviously, it takes time to adapt, but I don't think it's an unadaptable model.
They do have live ops. It's called TV series.
True, but those are packaged in seasons the same way. It's like you're packaging a thing and they get canned or switch out people and things like that. But yeah, absolutely, they have unions. The other thing I actually want to bring up around the unions that's very topical, I think, lately is we saw recent action a lot, of course, with TV and film and around actors and even voice actors and writers and things like that. And one of the big points of contention was AI. And so when you're talking about some of these jobs that are maybe a little more entry level, there's maybe also more potential for AI to impact them. So if there is, like right now, there's not a lot of bargaining power against your QA job getting replaced by some kind of AI farm that's doing all the playing and automated reporting. Obviously, like there's been a lot of that over time anyways. Like there's a lot of automation to try and save money in QA, or at least to try and test things faster because humans at some point can't scale to the level. So it makes sense. It wasn't really stealing jobs quite yet. But especially when we're talking about artists and outsourcing, you get outsourced to another country or you get insourced to AI. And it's obviously, in theory, a lot more cost effective to insource to AI than to outsource to another country.
And that was one of the things that Andrew Wilson was talking about when he was talking about, was it, the example was stadiums, building stadiums, where the initial process for building a stadium was something like 6 months. And through the use of AI, they were hoping to get it down to 6 days. Where with some of their current pipeline changes, I think the example you gave, they got it down to 6 weeks. And hey, if we got it all, a whole bunch of AI involved, then hey, we can get it down to 6 days. If we can go from 6 months to 6 days, that's huge savings. And we can either build more stadiums or, you know, what have you. So yeah, Tammy, there's your reason for artists to try and unionize is because, yeah, AI is certainly something that's going to be injected into the production work for the art team and for the engineering team at some level. Would you hire a junior person for $50,000 to $75,000 a year when you're going to have AI potentially write some front-end code for you?
I don't know if you guys literally saw there was a software engineer AI that got put out today by Cognitive, I think it was, called Devin, spelled exact same way as me. So apparently there's a even better engineer version of me than me out there. And that kind of stuff, I don't know if you've seen it, it's pretty impressive and definitely looks like there will be absolutely hiccups, but this stuff is definitely getting to the point where at least in certain use cases could be useful. But your example of the stadiums one, I think that what that ends up doing is revealing all the other bottlenecks you didn't realize were there that prevent it from being 6 months. You find out, oh, we can't, like that actually was like, it's great we scaled all this stuff down, but you can't really get it down to 6 months because of this. I think AI is going to be the same way, right? Where it's in other industries where we can scale certain parts down, but it reveals the other parts that are difficult to deal with in some ways. Like, hey, maybe it's the zoning that ends up taking everything from the stadium building or checking fire safety, all these checkboxes that end up being problematic. And then if you can't automate a lot of that because it's purposeful government regulation or something like that. adding those hurdles. But this is something we'll see play out, right? This isn't an immediate change or anything like that. It's more like a bit of a warning shot, but also if we're making progress in unionization, that does offer opportunity for us now at the start to figure out, okay, how do we tackle this? And maybe it just means less people needed for certain things. And those people will have to be specialized in working with the AI and actually using it in a way that's helping them as a tool or whatever. So it's not replacing a specific person, but it is scaling down the amount of people needed so that the people that are remaining can use it, work alongside it. And hopefully that's something that just multiplies the amount of studios that are possible, or about the games that are able to be built, like with your stadium example. Hey, if you could build it down in 6 months, but that reduces down the amount of people, are you losing people or are you building more stadiums? And I think there'll be some yin and yang with that, I think we'll have to consider. But in terms of government regulation and bottlenecks, one actually kind of working out in our favor lately is the smackdown happening in Europe on Apple, the DMA going into effect in Europe. I'm not usually a big fan of a lot of the European regulation, but in this case, yes, more please.
I know, yes. We've been talking about this because Apple has been, you know, making waves around all of this coming into effect now in March 7th, finally went into effect. So that is the Digital Markets Act, or DMA. And just as a reminder, it's a European regulation. A lot of what we talk about can be contained to just European users, European practices. Sometimes when Europe has put in these regulations, we've seen it unlock opportunity for other, basically like it's the first step of like many to other countries following suit. But right now it is contained to Europe. And I think we see that with Apple also being like, hey, it's contained to Europe, so we're containing it to Europe. So yeah, we've seen a lot of twists and turns. And of course, Apple released their policy changes, which have more caveats and twists and turns. Just to take a step back and go over what it actually means in theory for developers, is in theory, platforms like Google and Apple have to allow third-party payment providers other than the default that Google or Apple Pay give. They have this regulation around letting developers steer to off-platform web stores without retaliation. So things like web shops that we've talked about, and we've seen a lot of teams implement and see significant added revenue. There had to be like a lot of tiptoeing around how to do it to not be full out of compliance with Apple and Google. And now you can more easily do it without fear of not being compliant and getting your dev account shut down and all that stuff. They have to allow third-party storefronts on their platform. Here, we're going to continue to see that saga between Epic Games and Apple, because that's where that's playing out, right? With Apple, Epic really pushing hard to get their app store on iOS in Europe. And they have to allow direct side loading of apps. So what that means is you should be able as a developer to have go to mywebpage.com and download the game from there instead of having to go to the app store. But all of this, the way that Apple is implementing it, is comes with a bunch of caveats. So the guidelines that they put in is that, first of all, to be able to do the direct side loading of apps and, you know, be allowed to do this, you have to be in good standing for 2+ years with Apple. So that basically blocks Epic, because they shut down their account, which means that they were not in good standing, right? So you already see that playing out. You have to have over 1 million downloads on iOS in Europe in the prior calendar year. So basically there are no cutting off small teams from being able to unlock this. And you have to get over a scary looking bunch of warnings that players need to approve if they sideload your app. The other piece is that the runtime fee that they announced earlier this year, I think in January, is still mentioned, like they didn't backtrack from that. So question being is, will we actually see any changes? I think that we're at least seeing the EU regulators come at Apple, not around games, with the whole like Spotify and like music competition, like a close to $2 billion or €2 billion fine, you know, it's something. But my first question to hear your guys' thoughts is, will that be enough to really get them to like eventually loosen their grip? And the other question is more food for thought is like, what are the possible unintended consequences from these regulations, right? Like we can see a lot of positive and we can see a lot, as I mentioned, like opening the door to them. But we can also see just stuff that crowds the space in some way or makes it hard for developers. And my example there is like, we all have to accept those cookie pop-ups because of a European regulation for the GDPR. And it was like, now it's just going to spam you every time you go to a website. Curious to hear your guys' thoughts.
Yeah. Given it's like Apple says, okay, we're going to do this. And that's the part that they shout really loudly. Hey, we're going to allow for third-party websites. We're going to allow for all this. And then they very quietly put in, as you say, here's all the rules and restrictions. Here's all the fine print in order for you to allow you to do that. I really wonder what percentage of companies are going to be able to do it, what percentage of companies are going to want to do those things, because they do require the companies to accept the new terms and conditions with the download fees and the new style of Apple pulling any fees from the developers. There's a number of extra steps that developers are going to have to undertake. Are they actually going to see any benefit from it? Apple saying, hey, if you decide to do sales through outside of our store, we're still going to charge you 27%, knowing that you're going to be incurring 3% charging fees for using Exola or some other third-party platform for managing your payment systems. So in the end, does Apple win only just because they're still going to get the money that they would have gotten if they'd gone through the store, and they've put in so many barriers or unfavorable conditions that most developers would just say, you know what, it's just not worth it. Let's just keep on doing what we're doing right now.
As you said, Tammy, like it's definitely going to lead to probably worse user experiences, at least with the scare screens and stuff like that. Just like the GDPR, like the cookies pop up on every single website. That's extremely annoying. Although at this point, I actually have stopped really paying attention to it or noticing it. I'm just clicking the I accept. And that's probably actually worse for security at the end, unfortunately, because now I'm clicking I accept and it's who knows what I'm even accepting at this point because you just get so used to it. But to your point, Dave, in terms of who would want to use this and why, I think it's interesting to consider that if it's in theory worse than complying, then the people who will do this are the people that find out some other way to turn this to their advantage. If you're like then suddenly getting people onto your website buying stuff, and obviously you have to report all of that to Apple, is there some other unlock by getting people onto your website buying stuff in terms of customer relationship, in terms of cross promotion, in terms of, hey, ad revenue from the website? There's... if someone figures out a really solid unlock for that, those people are going to be the ones that are willing to do it.
Yeah, there certainly is. And I think the larger companies will certainly see the benefit of owning the relationship, being able to have that direct communication with the consumer rather than having to go through Apple as the intermediary for that. So I do think that a number of companies will see that advantage of being able to now directly talk with their consumers and be able to upsell them on other games, upsell them on merchandise. As you said, really take advantage of the fact that where the consumer is on your website and you have the opportunity to do more than just pitch them on that one particular game when they're on that landing site.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it's an opportunity for someone to get creative, right, and really figure this out. And who knows, maybe that'll actually be a really important thing for the next stage, because free-to-play is in kind of a tough spot right now in a lot of ways. And maybe this pushes people to come up with a new solution, even if it's not really directly about Apple, but it still forces thinking out of the box when it comes to dealing with the current user acquisition problems and things like that, where this ends up unlocking that. Could be net benefit. Obviously, in the meantime, though, it sounds like in general, they're just trying to make it really not something you want to use. And in Google, it sounds like it's doing some similar things. So it's like right now we still have that duopoly for the most part. Obviously, there is alternatives in some other countries. But as far as like the sort of global landscape, it's primarily that duopoly that we're having to deal with. And if they're both in lockstep, it becomes problematic to do something else, which is where a lot of the problem is. We don't really have a new platform to really move to the way we did from Facebook Canvas over to mobile. And so maybe we do at some point in the near future.
And I think Google does definitely provide an example of what it probably will look like with Apple, in that Google allows for sideloading. You can go download games from other stores as it is right now with Google. But the Play Store is where the vast majority of people go to download. They're not going to the Samsung store. They're not going to other storefronts that do offer Android games. The vast majority of them are still just downloading through Google Play.
Yeah, and I think the big advantage of that sideloading stuff isn't necessarily for running it as a business kind of thing. It's more opportunities where, let's say you want to do some sort of testing and you're not going to be in compliance with Apple, or you don't want to go through that whole headache or the dealing with test flight and all those other things. There's a lot of use cases for sideloading APKs outside of just uses, especially Web3. That was a big thing early on when you wanted to start doing mobile stuff and everyone was unsure of the policies. APK sideloading was a way you could deal with that. And so there's definitely those. But again, as you pointed, there's not really like a business model around it, right? At the moment, people have tried. There are alternative things like F-Droid, and Amazon tried its app store and stuff like that. So it's not a mainstream thing, but it would be fantastic still to have an iOS as an alternative. But it sounds like they've really locked down who can do it in a pretty restrictive way. It's like, not only do you have to be in good standing, which, as Tammy pointed out, definitely is, I don't think it was purposely put into Target Epic, but they certainly were happy with that being a side effect of it. But also, like, it's the limiting to the $1 million and all that. It also sounds like they're limiting the particular type of customer. And since the good standing thing, it can't be a new customer, right? They have to have that 2 years backlog. So they're actually setting new opportunists back 2 years by having to like wait to be able to do anything unless they say partner up with a developer that's already in good standing.
Yeah, when you were talking about like the benefits of sideloading, I was like, for the game dev side of my brain was like, yes, please. That just makes it so much easier.
Yeah, it seemed like they were trying to create a loophole with the enterprise stuff that they did, but it was so severely limited and not like a great system. And it just reiterated the kind of need for that. And there's so many times, as you said, with game development, testing out new builds and things like that. And I'm always glad I'm on Android for those because it's just so much easier. But it is a security thing. And I understand where Apple comes from in the sense of that. But clearly, there's probably a middle ground, and maybe this regulation is pushing them towards that, which it sounds like they're at least vetting the developer to some extent, which helps with some of the security concerns, and I'm sure is the justification behind why they do it. But we'll see how it goes, right? This is first steps. This is like hopefully at the very least progress towards something. If not, then it would be fun to watch from afar here in the US to see if it has any impact. But if it becomes enough of a thorn in Apple's side to have sort of two different big country policies, that can be progress to where it becomes a global thing where it's just easier for them to just be, all right, fine, this is the policy for everywhere. We don't want to deal with the headache of having two separate things we have to do. And that's sometimes the benefit of doing these, is making it so hard for them to have two separate like SKUs or two separate versions of the OS, for example, or different weird restrictions they have to code around and bugs that come from that, to just be like, all right, forget it. It's not even worth the headache, like the headache for themselves at that point. So hopefully that's the case, but I think it'll be a while before we find out if that ends up being it. But in the meantime, I'm sure they'll just be pushing people over to Vision Pro and hoping they can get people on that for the moment as their new green pasture. But I think it's a little bit of a high bar when it comes to retail price for consumers. So we'll see. But speaking of retail consumers, and in this case, toys, a lot of interesting stuff still happening in that space.
Yeah, definitely. So there's been, I think, some little bits and pieces of good news that are starting to happen around the industry amongst all of the layoff talks, seeing a number of new game studios starting up, but we're also starting to see some new publishing efforts. So Mattel has announced that they are going to go forward and start doing self-publishing. Up to this point, they've mostly been working with the licensing model. Ubisoft and Gameloft licensing Hot Wheels games certainly been out there before. A number of Barbie games have been out there in the past. But Mattel is going to start now not just licensing out, but will actually start doing some development. So they're going to start off doing some co-dev where they actually fund the development. They'll fund the marketing and they'll do the publishing. But they're going to start small, maybe a game in the first year, maybe start adding a game or two after that. And for now, continue to do the vast majority through their licensing. They've got a number of partners in terms of who they work with, including NetEase. And then there's a new Barbie game that was just announced in partnership with Zynga's Rollic group that we're supposed to see later this year. But they do have some interesting brands that certainly appeals to probably the younger side of things in terms of the demographic. in addition to Barbie and Hot Wheels, and they have Bob the Builder. And there's always the potential for them to also start to expand into Roblox and into Fortnite as well. So it'll be interesting to see how Mattel slowly but surely, by the sounds of it, works into becoming a true transmedia company, not just doing toys, but they've got the success of movies with the Barbie movie and now moving more directly into games. For me, one of the interesting things I think will be the question of, will they end up doing a Disney where they end up going into games and then we're out of games. And then we're in the games, now we're out of games. Or will they stick with it being there for a while, similar to probably their most direct competitor, Hasbro, who has certainly been in games for a while now, and sounds like they probably will stay there for a while, especially with the ownership of some of their brands and companies such as Wizards of the Coast and some of the efforts that they've got there. Any thoughts in terms of Mattel? Are they going to stick around? Are they going to be Hasbro? Or are they going to be Disney?
Yeah, I will say that I haven't had a chance to dig deeper into their specific strategy on how they're going to approach this. So I would say, like, my only take here is it really depends on what their strategy is, because making games is, we say it a lot, like, making games is hard. It's not rocket science, but it is hard to make fun games. And they have to set up the organizations internally to be able to move at the speed that you need to move, to have the flexibility that you need, and just have that structure enable game making and not hinder it. And I think that's where a lot of IP holders do that step in, step out, because the way that they control the creative control of the properties also has a lot of impact on how well that kind of all gains momentum. So I think it depends on, like, how much a creative control they want to maintain and how does that look like. And what are the structures in actual, like, strategy on how they're tackling this? I think that they have a lot of properties where this could become a huge, you know, other arm of their business. So it has the potential, but it really comes down to, you know, as with most things, strategy and execution.
Yeah, I think, and it may even depend on just, do they have people internally already that maybe have the right experience or skills to be able to do this quickly, as opposed to having to hire all the people for that or to build, like, an internal studio. But if you think about it, this move does make sense when you just look at toys in general. One of their biggest competitors is a kid with an iPad right now. Like, it's not toys the same way it used to be with kids. Obviously, there's an element to that, but with kids just glued to their digital devices now, toys have to be in that space. And also thinking about the history of Saturday morning cartoons and that sort of ability to sell toys that way, that doesn't really exist as much anymore. So what is the relevance now? Maybe you get into games as a way to help sell toys, and maybe that becomes the thing to push people to toys, or becomes a Skylanders-esque kind of experience where it works with the toys. There's a lot of opportunity there, and maybe that's what Mattel sees, or maybe it's just a transmedia play of, like, why are we not making video games of our hot properties to continue to extend monetization? Because at least for now, when you go into the theater to see Barbie, there's no in-app purchases you could make during it. So this does seem like a monetization opportunity for them for properties, right? Like, same when you buy toys, right? You got to deal with the whole retail chain, and there's only so many upsells they can make. Whereas with digital, sky's the limit in terms of what they can do monetization-wise, which is, that's Hasbro. They know that very well. And so this is maybe first steps, and hopefully they don't pull a Disney. To be fair, like, Disney did some pretty cool stuff early on and then eventually bailed. So it is too bad to see that. But at the same time, like, it just wasn't their strength, and it's difficult. Sometimes they just do that and then start outsourcing or whatever. But I also am interested to see if this ends up, like, bleeding even into Web3, because we've seen a number, as you said, Hot Wheels was an example, one that went into Web3. There's quite a few others in terms of digital toys having a good overlap with NFTs. So there's always possibility that Mattel could further dabble in that sort of overlap as well, to do something that maybe has some interesting relevance in that tech of, hey, you've got your Hot Wheels, you can scan it into the game, and it's also an NFT, and there's definitely opportunity. But again, depends on that internal expertise or who they hire. If they have to hire people and depend on contractors, it's most likely to be short-lived, I think, unless they find, like, a lot of immediate success, because it could just be a huge cost thing that it's just maybe a light marketing vehicle at that point. But I hope they're successful.
It sounds like, because they're starting off with CoDev, I would suggest that they probably are starting off hiring sort of those top line individuals, be that the creative director, executive producer, people that have framed the overall creative for it, and then find a studio to actually build it out rather than trying to hire them all internally, as you said.
Yeah. And as mentioned, it's not like this is Barbie's first game. There's like the old, I was just,
oh, six gazillion. You know,
yeah, the old CD-ROM games and everything else, Flash games. I'm sure like it's a long history to tap into. It's just finding like stuff for the modern market, but it seems like mobile is still a very good fit for those types of products. So we'll see what they put out, and hopefully it will be at least of good quality. If not, maybe the employees can unionize, and we have a whole bunch of other stuff related to it that we can be pushing, or maybe they can use some AI to help it. Lots of different stuff going on in the games industry that could work out or against Mattel. So definitely good luck to them, though, because I think I'd love to see toys maintain some sort of relevance that makes sense in the sort of digital culture and not just fade out in, you know, in favor of just screens in front of your face all day, as much as that is my life. But yeah, lots of interesting opportunity, and we'll keep an eye on it. But in the meantime, I just want to thank you guys for joining us. And of course, we're all scrambling to prep for GDC. And so definitely make sure to reach out to us if you want to talk with anyone at Novic at GDC. We had a link in the last show notes. I'll try to make sure that gets in this show notes as well in terms of the formed meetup, although it might be very well booked up at this point. But you can always email podcast@novic.co, as well as use, I think, a contact form on the website. But it's definitely getting close to the date, so make sure to hit us up beforehand, because it will be a very busy GDC from the vibe I've gotten. It's going to be a lot going on, despite the fact that the bad news sort of time, it's definitely not slowing down. So make sure to check that out. And if you're going to GDC, of course, have a safe trip there and enjoy the show and all the stuff going on with it. But in the meantime, get some rest this weekend, and we'll catch you guys the week after GDC, as we will all be there. And of course, hopefully we'll have some great stuff to talk about post-GDC.
If you enjoyed today's episode, whether on YouTube or your favorite podcast app, make sure to like, subscribe, comment, or give a 5-star review. And if you want to reach out or provide feedback, shoot us a note at podcast@novic.co or find us on Twitter and LinkedIn. Plus, if you want to learn more about what Novic has to offer, make sure to check out our website, www.novic.co. There, you can sign up for the number one games industry newsletter, Novic Digest, or contact us to learn about our wide-ranging consulting and advisory services. Again, that is www.novic.co. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.